I'm speaking today with Eugene Danielkis, co-founder and CEO of Mambu, a SaaS, software as a service platform, alternative to core banking, or maybe the future of core banking. How would you describe what you have?
Think of it basically as the engine for designing and service different loan and deposit products. It's an alternative to core banking in the sense that if you were doing banking services, traditionally a banking platform is what you would get. But for nowadays, where you're trying to build a business a bit more agile, using and buying a core banking system and trying to implement that, especially in the lending space, just doesn't make sense. The timelines and the costs of setting that up and the flexibility of it aren't just there for the speed the market moving. So we wanted to take the approach, just like, you know, Salesforce did in the CRM, and bring a product that provides you 80% of the functionality you need to manage any lending or deposit product, and then bring it to the SaaS world and make it easy to integrate through an API layer.
Take me through this journey of how core banking has evolved and where you play at the moment. In the old days, core banking was a very monolith, enterprise level type infrastructure, mainframe or closed architecture and all that.
Right.
And then it became open systems, and you find that the smaller, newer players were able to come in and compete on price. But the model actually remained more or less the same.
Right.
Monolithic model with a GL. Without your GL, you can't start building a core banking system kind of thing. So where are you? What is your proposition in the evolution of bank technology?
Our evolution is very similar, I guess, to, as I was saying before, the same evolution that you've seen in other industries. So, for instance, with what Salesforce has done with CRM, so take effectively the same sort of functionality you had, or at least 80% of the functionality you need to manage your customers, and reduce it to an order of magnitude less of complexity and cost, and make it configurable through the application. So instead of going in to customize code, everyone in the world runs on one Salesforce platform, and they configure it through the application, right? They configure their fields or workflows and all of that. It's exact same philosophy with what we do on the banking side.
Right.
So if you want to go design a new product and you come up with your interest rules, your fee structure, everything else, you just go into Mambu and you specify that through the user interface and you have your product ready to go.
So is that a solution that actually exists on something like Amazon Web Services? And
we do use Amazon Web Services as our infrastructure for most of our customers. So you get the benefit, of course, of the Amazon infrastructure underneath it.
Right. You kept referring back to Salesforce as a comparison, the big difference being that in Salesforce, the average institutional player has no problems going on the cloud and driving from there. Banks never wanted to do that, so they always wanted systems to be proprietary to what they do. So where are you seeing the interest coming from? What type of institutions, and what are they willing to give up in order to be able to use your model? They access your functionalities or your
solutions? The whole application.
The whole application.
Yes, yeah.
And then they can download that to do any form of customization, or they...
No, there's basically no customization. All of our 160 sites of Mambu run an exact same application. So there's no customization to it. I think what's changing in the evolution perspective is you're not building, as you said, a large monolith anymore. They're using Mambu as one engine, and they're using the APIs to plug and play different best-of-breed products for coming up with credit scoring, origination, for instance. They pump data out of Mambu into different BI tools. So it's more of a web-based architecture, picking and choosing different products as opposed to building a single monolith.
Right.
So that's a completely different approach to the architecture. On the cloud side of it, I don't think the story is very different than what we've seen when Salesforce came around also in the late 90s, early 2000s. You know, everyone was concerned about moving their customer and sales data to the cloud, and now it's a given. And I think we're seeing the exact same trend now happening in banking. I mean, even if you look from the regulatory side, there was really nothing that was talking about cloud technology in the last 5 years. And in the last two or three, you've seen Singapore, Netherlands, UK now, and a few other countries where the regulators are actually encouraging and greenlighting the use of cloud, because they realize that the security that data centers like Amazon can provide are far better than anything except for maybe the top one or two tier banks could do themselves. So why not provide the best technology and the best security and best services for all the different organizations?
But a number of these regulators are almost specifying a closed cloud rather than an open cloud. You know, their idea is they haven't moved to to the open cloud world an average bank in any of these countries accessing a Mambu, which does not even sit on a server in that country.
It might not sit in a server in their country, but as far as the way that the bank accesses it, it actually has quite a lot of permission and flexibility in how they set up the access rights. So an organization that deploys Mambu can deploy it in a way where they only have access to it. They only have access to it from within all the walls of the bank business themselves. So it can be accessed from just you logging into it externally. So you have a lot of controls from how you actually access the data, even though the data centers you use might not be physically in the country. But I mean, it's the internet. I mean, even if you access your bank account, your data packet flows from all right. over the world to access it.
So I'm curious about this 160 client base that you have around the world. What would characterize them in a generic way? Like, what do they tend to be? Do they tend to be smaller institutions? Do they tend to be newer institutions? Do they tend to be institutions in trouble and need to move quickly?
No, it tends to be more institutions. There's three types of projects we primarily do. One of them is the organizations that are starting up, and that could be really anything from a fintech lending startup to a new challenger bank in the UK and a few other markets we're working in. And they're building something out completely from scratch, and they want to use a cloud-first digital approach to their whole entire business. And so they start, obviously, with a platform like ours, but then everything that they do and build around it is also cloud-first and digital-first. So that's completely the Greenfield initiative. The other project that we have, which is fairly common, is an established organization that wants to move into a new product line. So we've had companies that do consumer lending and they want to move into SME lending. We're working with a project right now with a tier one bank that wants to go also moving out and do completely lean automated online SME origination. We're working with a telco, for instance, that has a 50 million customer base, and they want to start doing consumer lending and additional banking products to that. So they're not a traditional bank, they're a telco, but they're moving into the financial services
space. Okay, there's a second category.
Yeah, and the third one is more about the sort of the transformational category. That's where an organization's been doing things the exact same way for the last 10 or 20 years. And it's not a case of them replacing their old core banking system with Mambu. It's them re-looking at their whole entire processes, seeing where they can put in automation, where they can put in new customer channels. And so they really think strategically, what should our business look like in 5-10 years?
Okay.
And part of that transformation process ends right. up being putting in a platform
so,
like ours.
So what's the largest client that you've seen? Like, what is the throughput? How many customer base? And
The largest clients we have has about 1 million or so active accounts, which they're managing with us. Yeah, a mix of both loans
and deposits.
This one's in Africa.
Okay. Yeah. And in China, what sort of clients are you finding that are talking to you?
In China right now, it's more about the small business lenders. We're working with a few customers who are not China-based companies, but are expanding an operational footprint into China. So they want to have an office and footprint. They might have investors which are coming in from outside China, and they want to have established a presence in China.
Right.
Probably usually with a joint entity with someone right. in China as well. But it's then usually small business lending.
So these small business lenders, well, not necessarily banks, they look at something like what you provide, and say, "Yep, let's take and run with it." You know,
yeah.
But what is your conversation with the traditional players who have a core banking, you know, system on their site,
yeah.
with 1,000 programmers, you know, doing line coding still? When yeah. they look at something like what you offer, are they skeptical? Are they asking more questions now? Are they using you for pilots at least?
They're using us for pilots, but I would say it's their mentality is they feel like there's different parts of their business, often the small business lending side of it, maybe a little bit digital banking, a little bit consumer lending, which they feel is being attacked by the different fintech companies and perhaps at threat. Or they see a market which is underserved, which often happens in Southeast Asia, it happens in Africa as well, where they feel like there's a market they could tap into. But they need to do it in a much more lean way, both from a process and technology and cost point of view. And so they realize that the current infrastructure they have is not well suited to it. Kind of the analogy they use is they're driving a cruise ship, but to go after these markets, they need a speedboat. So their idea for these ones is to launch something that's fairly separate. They wall it off from the rest of the business. I mean, they might own a subsidiary, it reports your balance sheet back to the core business, but it's operationally independent and technologically independent. And that gives them a chance to then both test out new technologies, but also go after new markets and act in a way that's more fintech-like and independent. Because you can imagine, of course, if you're running a bank, it's got a multi-billion dollar balance sheet, and now suddenly someone comes and say, I want to spend $5 million to go launch SME lending, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to have a request for the IT team. But this request is going to go at the very, very bottom of that stack, obviously, for the IT team, as you said. have many other projects of just keeping the bank alive they're working on. So that sort of timelines is going to kill the innovative digital initiative, right? So they look for a completely separate operational stack and they use our technology for that.
Right. So now, where does the data actually sit? Because many countries have regulation that they don't allow customer information to get out of the country. You need some form of presence in the country.
We use the different Amazon data centers, which they have kind of around the world. So, for instance, they have them in Singapore, in Australia. They have them, of course, all over the US. They have a couple in the UK, in Germany as well. So we use whichever the data center is that's actually closest to the customer. For a lot of the cases, we haven't seen, once you actually have the conversations with the regulators and you explain to them how you actually do data security and how you manage the customer data, you'll quickly find that they will appreciate the fact that the service security you can provide, if you set up the right sort of cloud infrastructure for the bank, is far better than what they could probably do themselves. And so if you talk them through their actual concerns, operational, practical concerns, and you show them how you address that in your usage of the cloud, then it has greenlighted quite a few different projects for that. You can't really just put all of cloud in one same bucket, right? Because there's different ways to set up different environments and different ways to set up access to it.
So in your conversation with regulators, which regulators do you think are further down the road in terms of understanding the need to deconstruct what they think, where they think the cloud should exist, and are much more comfortable today talking to a company like yours and also Amazon Web Services, and to think a little bit about the fact that an Amazon Web Service might probably have a lot more security than their traditional bank, and in fact they can't go on hammering the head of the local bank to out of fear of not knowing if something hits who's responsible or how they're going to take that.
The best thing is to actually be direct about it and talk about the fears, right? So we go to them and we say, well, what are your concerns about this, right? And it's not usually unfounded. It's usually not, it's just a matter of not knowing, first of all, how the infrastructure is set up and what the operational risks and concerns are. And then you just simply talk about them. So are you concerned about, the data center going out of being unavailable? Are you worried about Mambu or Amazon going out of business? So you talk to them about the concerns and then you explain to them how you have a practical strategy along with the bank, with the financial institution to mitigate those risks. And you simply address those one by one. So you're saying, well, if the data center goes down or if you're worried about those two countries going at war, here's how we would actually address that such that you still have access to all of your customer data. Mm-hmm. And so there's practical things you can put in place to address all those concerns, and we just simply talk through those ones.
So which regulators are further down the road, you think?
We've talked to so many. I mean, we've talked to the ones, in South Africa, Argentina, in Germany now, in the UK, in Ghana, Singapore. I mean, we've talked to so many right now. I mean, quite frankly, a lot of the conversations are not necessarily, well, they're led by the financial institution, right? Because the regulator is asking the institution, well, how are you going to deal with this scenario? And of course, we and Amazon have to be able to support them in answering that question. But at the end of the day, it's the bank's concern, right? So for instance, if one of their approaches is they take an escrow agreement with us, for instance, right? Or they have a local copy of the database, which they back up on a nightly basis, that's a process which the bank has to set up. And we simply have to be able to explain to them how we support that process and how we make sure the data is encrypted and secure and so forth. But so the questions are primarily to the financial institution. And the thing is, what we're seeing now is a lot of more of them are willing and wanting to have that conversation. In the past, I would say maybe 3-4 years ago, initially conversations were like, well, the regulator, I'm not really sure what the regulator thinks about the cloud, so I'm not really going to go look at that, because they didn't even want to broach that subject. Whereas now they realize the business benefit and they say, no, actually, why don't you help us to have a conversation with the regulator? Let's bring Amazon into the room. We see the real business value in this, and we actually want to have a conversation with it. Whereas before, if they couldn't find some document that said cloud is okay in big bold letters, they would simply not even raise that issue, or now they actually want to explore it deeper.
Right. Walk me a little bit through the evolution of your company. there must be thousands, literally, of fintech companies trying to automate or even bring on a Java-based platform any aspect of the core banking system, the GL, the data, analytics, and also the core systems of lending and deposits.
Yeah.
But somehow you seem to have broken through. You seem to have you're closer to becoming mainstream than any other player of your kind. you know, why? I mean, what is it about what you've done right?
I don't think too many companies have actually taken a fresh approach at this and designing and architecting a system in a way that you would from the development point of view, from using the cloud infrastructure, and from the way that you set up the basically the software nowadays. I don't think too many companies have actually taken a fresh look at that. And we did decide to go to the core of the issue. We sat down with a blank slate and we said, what would a system look like? What functionality should it have? How should it be flexible? Where should it be more constrained? How should we do our development processes? How should we use cloud technology? So we really sat down with a clean slate.
But when you took your approach, you basically had to question so many of the concerns that already exist in the minds of the existing customer base.
Yes.
Right? So you actually had to challenge conventional thinking. You know, so where was the breakthrough that came for you, where the next client was comfortable talking to you because someone else had actually bought into the way you look at?
Well, it sort of came client by client. I mean, every individual client, and even nowadays, so many of our projects come in through references because a lot of our clients speak well of us, and a lot of the opportunities that we have come in through the kind of the reference projects. It really just kind of builds up by just working with them step by step. So we like to work closely with our clients to develop the product, but because we only have one product and one code base, we have to kind of take their requests and try to generalize it. So there might be some ideas that we have from a customer that's doing SME lending in China, which applies very well to someone who wants to do something in the UK, or a consumer lender that's doing something in the US. So our approach has been working closely with the clients to develop the product, but to never customize it for a client. And I think that's something that we've been quite strict about from the product development from the very beginning.
Always generic. Always.
Always to generalize their needed functionality and come back to, you know, a little bit like an annoying child and ask them why they need something. You get back to the root of the issue and you design the functionality to support the real need. And then you invest additional effort to design in a way that's generalizable, such that it doesn't just solve the problem today, but might solve something they need in a month, or might solve something that a client needs in a
region. Where do you think a company like Microsoft went wrong? Because they would have been an intermediary before someone like you came along. Because before them, there were mostly the closed system, the closed-end infrastructure. And then they tried to put it up on their platform and even convince the banks that a non-traditional player can scale, can handle the volume, the needs of a typical bank. Mm-hmm. But you've now leapfrogged that. You've put it on the web, and you're selling what is essentially a generic system.
Well, I mean, I think it's just a focus for them. I mean, I don't think I don't know too much about the Microsoft strategy in the financial space. I mean, I think a lot of their, we were obviously looking at the Microsoft Azure Cloud versus Amazon Cloud, and both are terrific products, and we just made the investment in Amazon from the beginning. As far as their product strategy, I think very few companies wanted to go tackle to the core of the issue of building out the transactional engine, basically, and the product servicing engine, effectively, for so many different types of lending and deposit businesses out there. It's just not something that too many people wanted to take a fresh approach at. But we kind of believe from the very beginning that the SaaS model is going to win out, that the cloud is going to become completely normal in financial services. It's just a matter of time. And also we believed in a very open API integrated architecture where companies would choose best of breed products. So they would choose us as an engine, and they would choose a different products which they buy or they integrate. So I think we initially, from the very beginning, we kind of just believed in that's where the trend was going, and that needed a brand new platform from the beginning.
Right. Tell me a little bit about how you are configured as an organization. How many employees you have, and how many of those spend time on tweaking the system so that the generalities can be productized. That means over time you'll be selling the same same changes that you make to new clients and stuff like that. And how much of your employee base spend time with regulators, or what comes across as customization, but actually answering the questions of the different jurisdictions that you sell into?
Sure. So, I mean, we're a team of just shy of 80 people right now.
That's amazing. That's incredibly amazing.
And it's growing quite quickly, so we should be close to about 130, 140 by the end of this year, including our office in Singapore and Miami. And about half of that now, and probably even by the end of the year, is going to be somewhere on our engineering team still. So that includes our developers, our cloud administrators, and so half the team is still technical in some way. But I think a lot of the work happens is before we actually start building out the feature, it comes in through both the sales process and also the project process. So when we work with our customer, we tailor a project for them where we put usually one or two different application specialists for them.
No, this is 80 people, and so do you outsource your line coding at least?
No,
or is there any form of line coding at all?
No, everything's within our organization. So remember, if you're an organization and you wanted to come up with something that's customized to outside of Mambu, right? You know, you came up with some crazy fee structure, which we don't support in the product and we wouldn't really support because you wanted to base the fees based on sports scores or something, right? Doesn't make sense as a core feature within Mambu. Our job was to make sure that you have the functionality within the core product and through the APIs to be able to build that little fee engine outside of it and integrate it through the APIs. So there's some organizations, of course, that build a couple of these little pieces of code snippets around Mambu, but we never build that for our customers. We simply provide them the toolkit if they want to do so. But effectively, no, it's completely our own engineering team, and that's the scope of.
So the most difficult customer you've had, and the implementation or the customization aspect of it, what's the lead time?
So, I mean, we don't really customize. If you kind of look at a typical project plan, usually during the sales process, we figure out if there is any additional...
You give them the tool set, so they
customize. We give them the tool set, but we identify during the sales process if there's additional functionality which we might have to develop in Mambu, for instance. You know, for instance, if you do compounding interest and Mambu doesn't support compounding interest, we just cover that pretty early in the sales process as a quick example. We just simply then have put together a project plan, and part of that project plan, one work stream, will be the fact that we develop compounding interest as a new feature in the product. Of course, it's not customized to you, it's just part of the core product and available to all of our customers past and all of our customers in the future as well.
So it's not a catalog that you develop, it's actually put into the system.
That's right, yeah. So it becomes really just core functionality, and then our project team is really just working with you as a customer to capture your business requirements and to help set up Mambu in the best way to support them, because there's literally millions of configuration items you can have, combinations of them, that is. And so our project team is just simply talking to you, okay, what do you want to do? What does your product look like? And then we work with you to literally go through the application in real time and go set up the product. And we try out some accounts. We see, okay, what happens when you do prepayments? What happens when accounts go late? And we work with our customers in real time to set that up. So if you have your requirements and you know exactly what you want, there's no reason why you couldn't have Mambu set up within a day. But the reality is it's a collaborative process, because you are also at the same time starting probably your marketing campaign for your new product. You're probably integrating it out to your
other systems. It's funny because what you're describing is what actually the intermission phase was. The Indian IT companies, which had exactly what you're saying in terms of adding the customization back into the core product set, but they never did that. They had large developer pools,
yeah.
You know, and whereas you are putting it all back into the...
Well, we as a company, we have to. And the reason that we have to is because our operational commercial model forces us to. So the incentive for a company to keep customizations and keep developers is when you charge man days for developing it, right? Because you can, of course, imagine that it becomes commercially attractive for someone to say, well, you have a new feature request, but let me just see how much that's going to be. I'll build that customization for you. It could be an extra $50,000 plus an extra 20% to maintain it, right? And you keep adding that on. So it becomes a little bit commercially addictive to build that out.
Yeah.
Well, we don't really do that because our commercial model is completely subscription-based, and subscription-based usually tied to different key business metrics. So it might be portfolio under management or revenues, whatever it is for the customer, but it's usually a key business metric on a subscription basis. So for us, there's that's really the key driver and the key value of our business. So there's little incentive for us to try to spend get professional services days out of you, or to maintain a large pool of customizations, because that will fundamentally slow our business down over the long term. So we're pretty strict about saying no to customizations.
So that's okay. So what are the kind of clients that you can see that you're not going to pick up because you know that's not going to fit your model?
it's probably the clients that I want to be replacing systems instead of transforming. So even organizations which are, if it's a greenfield initiative, it's great because we get to work together with them and we get to design the products and the whole entire process with them. If it's someone that's transforming, that means they're really rethinking about how they're doing their processes, and they're also open to coming up with new approaches. But if someone who's just simply replacing and saying, I have this whole entire process and I have this old core banking system with it, and I want to switch out that old core banking system and put in a new core banking system, but I want to keep everything else the same, then that almost certainly won't work with us, because it means they're not really changing much of the business, and it means they're most likely going to try to force things which they've done for legacy reasons, even if they're, some of them that we've seen which are simply fundamentally wrong, but they've just done it, and they will try to force that into our product as opposed to trying to collaboratively come up with a new way of working. So I think it's those pure replacement sort of projects that are will unlikely be a good fit for us. It's organizations that are kind of digitizing and thinking about it either from a greenfield or really a business transformation perspective, that I think those ones will find a way to work together with them.
It's amazing, because I can only see that you're learning a lot of things as you go along. And there are areas like cybersecurity, for example, which you're probably learning a lot of things which is way ahead of just about anyone else, because you're running a platform on a global basis and serving it's very specific financial institutions in different markets.
Yeah, we get the benefit, of course, of taking knowledge in from different customers and applying them. So we could be working with a telco in Asia and working with a bank in the UK and working with another fintech company in the US. And when you get to work with all of them, when you have one product and also one project team that fundamentally works across all of them, you get to take that learnings from all the different companies, apply it back to additional projects with future customers and back to the product as well. And then you really find the similarities between them.
So this is software as a service.
Yes,
but the world is moving to yet another realm, which is service. That means without the software component that is that the bank owns its own, owns the business itself.
Right.
Where else the whole thing is hived off to, to a service platform.
Yes. So we've seen a few of those sorts of projects, and we have a couple that we're working on. Effectively, they're working probably with another company, like a system integrator, or another company that's basically providing additional services beyond us. So they're still using our platform to drive the engine, design the product, service their accounts, all of those things, but they may provide additional business services to the customers that we don't. So we've seen a few of those sort of projects, and we kind of fit well into those, because it's the software as a service mentality aligned to
the service. So it's also the kind of solution that you might actually sell through some of these service providers, like consulting firms, for example.
Potentially, it depends on what the organization wants to do, right? The ones that feel like tech and having close ownership of the different pieces of software is important to them, they want to be able to have access to Mambu directly and be able to work with APIs and configure the application. Where there's others that feel like they just want someone to put all the different pieces together for them, and they want it to them basically to run the service for them. In which case, we're probably not working directly with the organization, but working with that company that is effectively gluing our products plus a few other SaaS products plus a few other bespoke things together, and we're provided to them effectively.
Actually, you kept mentioning Salesforce, but you're much closer to some of these budget airline websites, the budget airline systems, where you can start an airline or shut it down tomorrow, but you've got you can do that with a platform that already exists, that service all the budget airlines in a country or region. So
it's speed to market is definitely a big advantage, right? So I mean, the fact that you have a platform and they can configure it and you could be running with the APIs very quickly is a huge advantage. But it's not just for the launch of the project. I think it's also organizations taking into consideration that they don't really know what the tech landscape is going to look like and what the customer base will need. And so they want to keep maintaining that flexibility, right? So you don't want to build something and say, okay, I finally built this amazing architecture and that's the thing I'm going to run on for 5 years. Because the reality is you're going to have to change some products, you'll have to put in new pieces, you might change your mobile app, there might be new technologies out there. So organizations are trying to design themselves for change and flexibility, right? And we fit pretty well into that approach.
Okay. Final question. The data that you see flowing through your network or your platform. What's that telling you? And where is deposit systems going in general?
We ourselves haven't done much in the way of data analytics across our customer base. So we obviously have all the access to the data, but we haven't really done too much in the way of analytics across of it. I mean, our customers obviously do themselves because they have all of their data, customers, accounts, transactions, all in one place, which makes it really easy for them to do analytics and use it for things like credit scoring or BI or perhaps in the very near future, AI, as we probably heard about from the conference. But we ourselves are not really using the data too much for anything right now.
Thank you very much, Eugene, for this conversation. I'm very pleased to have met you.
Yeah.
And actually, the thinking is what is revolutionary here. And I hope that we will be able to build on this conversation in time to come.
Yeah, likewise. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.